out and connect with hundreds of other neurons, and then disconnect from those neurons. And so what this means, and this is very important when it comes to memory, you cannot recall the same memory twice. Every memory that you're recalling has been changed from the last time you recalled that memory.
Physiologically?
Physiologically. Now, here's the wonderful thing about that. Let's say you had a traumatic event or a negative event. That's certainly going to get embedded into the memory circuits of your brain. And then you come across a situation and something is similar to that old memory. The old memory comes up and it's rather the same. But imagine if you deliberately and consciously sat back in your chair, took a few deep breaths, do one of my favorite brain-changing exercises, which is to yawn.
Is that getting oxygen to your brain there?
No oxygen at all. It's actually slowing down the metabolism in an overly active part of your imagination, which tends to generate anxiety, fear, and worry. And so you kind of slow down this brain activity. This actually increases consciousness and awareness. And in this deeply relaxed state, when you recall a negative memory, an old worry, a fear, or a doubt that you've had, that memory is pulled up into working memory consciousness. But then when you're done with that memory, about 20 seconds later, because that's as long as it stays in consciousness, it gets reconsolidated, that's the actual neuroscientific term, with the relaxation state that you created. So now that memory of that negative event or thought or feeling has a relaxed quality to it. The next time you call up that memory, that new memory comes up. And so you experience the old trauma, the old negativity, the crappy emotional feeling that you had before, but you're relaxed, which is a pleasure-oriented state. So now it actually becomes a little more pleasurable to pull up a negative memory because that's what you did the last time. And so you can do this like 2, 3, 4, 6 times in a row and literally abolish the original memory sense that was filled with a negative experience.
So you can essentially desensitize it in a way.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, yes.
What does a negative memory look like in a cell? I mean, does it look all wary and freaked out? I mean, what?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you remember, you know, I want you to have this kind of image of like that each neuron is like an octopus with 1,000 tentacles and everything else. And so it's wiggling around and swimming around all the time, and it forms a little community of, you know, we don't know whether it's 100,000 neurons to hold one particular thought or memory or image or whatever. Mm. We don't really know that, but we know that they do form these little circuits, and they actually light up like a little pinpoint area when you're in a brain scan machine and you're recalling a particular kind of memory. So we're getting good at identifying where positive and negative memories are collected.
Interesting. Uh-huh.
And if you're really traumatized, you know, you've actually seen something horrible happen, you've been in a war zone situation, many times you'll see a lot of pinpoints going on all throughout the outer layer of your brain.
Uh-huh.
And it's almost like your memory has been just shattered. It hasn't been pulled together. And so combination of neuroscience, sometimes even using different kinds of strong magnetic forces, can help to turn these memory circuits on and off. So some of the octopuses wake up and wiggle a whole bunch. But interesting thing is that the ends of neurons that send information out to other neurons are called axons. They're the ones that extend and grow and move. So they can disconnect from one set of community, your octopuses in your brain, and connect with a different set. So you can pair up, a negative, crummy octopus with a happy octopus, and then you get kind of a balance.
That's how you reform habits.
That's correct.
I've seen the visual images of these, digital images. I mean, it's so fascinating to watch.
God, yes.
I think that is so amazing. I don't know how you capture that stuff, but
It's getting better and better. It's called an fMRI brain scan machine. It's a moving picture of what's happening in your brain when you do an action or hold a particular kind of thought.
You can see these neurons with these little tentacles
You can't see those tentacles in the human brain. On this one, we have to unfortunately take interesting microscopes and stick them through a tube down into a rat brain. And we don't know why, but most of our human beings say, no, thank you, I'll pass on that particular part.
And now that makes sense to me. But the science is interesting, where you see the neurons connecting, and then when you start to retrain the person, the neuron changes and connects to a different direction and another neuron, and that's a habit changing.
Exactly.
Fascinating.
And Eric Kandel won the Nobel Prize for this. He took a single neuron from a sea slug and showed that you could teach this neuron how to become interested in the world, extend itself, grow new axons, build up more, change its behaviors. You could traumatize it. It would shrink and pull away. That's what I'm saying. Every single neuron in the brain has a mind of its own. And so that's why a mouse brain and a mammal brain, consciousness exists almost exactly the same in all mammals as in human beings.
That's why science and spirituality are so fascinating when you link the two together. So, all right, so what depression could be or anxiety could be are habitual.
Depression is a depression, most, I would say that 90% of all anxiety and depression that a person has is an utter and complete fantasy. It's the belief that we pull up an old memory about something that hasn't worked in the past and maybe didn't work 10 times in the past, and now we add the idea because it didn't work 10 times in the past, it probably won't work in the future. So we have that thought. That gets built into that little memory. So now every time I sit down and I say, let's say I'm going to try to lose some weight. Oh, now all my weight memories flood into this little tiny area of consciousness, and it says, fail, 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 fail. Mm. What it's really saying is that it failed in the past, it failed in the past, it failed in the past. But memories don't have a notion of past. It's just a recollection of a success or a failure, a pleasure or a pain. And so we then add on to that. Because it's failed in the past, it's probably going to fail in the future. But the rest of the brain is rather stupid. It forgets the word probably.
So I have this little friend who every time she sleeps over at someone's house, she is a little friend of my daughter's, she threw up once when she slept over at another place. And
yep.
So she won't sleep over at anyone else's house because she had that one experience and she's terrified of throwing up again.
Right.
But how do you retrain that brain cell?
Oh, there's a million simple ways to do it. First of all, you have to realize that what that child has done, most children, what they would do is just associate house with that specific house.
And that's a neuron that built a bridge to another neuron. Okay.
But this child generalized that to all houses. So now whenever she sees a house and it doesn't have her bed in it, which you can visualize, then that creates a certain kind of anxiety based upon this old experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the interesting ways in which you can build a positive habit is by having the child do a bunch of guided fantasy. I mean, it's the same thing we do with when we read fairy tales and storybooks to our kids.
Oh, okay.
Have them engage in fantasies of going over to different houses. So if it was my kid with that problem, for example, I would say, sit down. Okay, we're going to play an imagination game. And we're going to go, you're going to pack your bag, take your sleeping bag, and we're going to go over to that really creepy haunted castle over there. And you're going to go into that haunted castle. Now, can you feel how scary it is? And you know it's going to be terrible. And you know that the moment you fall asleep, monsters are going to pop out of all the closets and everything else. Oh, yeah. Kids love this as a storytelling.
Okay.
Because they know it's a fantasy. But on another part of the brain doesn't know it's a fantasy. And then I'm going to say to that child, and this is kind of a flooding technique in psychotherapy, okay, now you can feel yourself beginning, you're going to throw up, right? You're going to throw up. Yes, yes, Dad, I'm going to throw up. Now, not only do you throw up, tons of vomit come out of your mouth. You're filling up the entire house. The entire house is filling up with vomit. Everyone's drowning. The house is floating down away to the ocean. And, of course, the kid's laughing at this particular time.
So you're oversensitizing the experience.
Well, I'm also making it a game. I'm making it silly. I'm making it funny. So I'm embedding into the memory of a house pleasure, silliness, ridiculousness, and everything else. And then,
why wouldn't you go after, like, you see a big clown and there's a bouncy house and everybody's smiling and happy? Why wouldn't you go after that?
Well, I'd go there next.
Okay.
So the next thing I'd do, I'd bring it down. And then if I wanted to, then I might shift the conversation and say, now I really want you to visualize. And this is how you retrain most negative memories with adults or children. I'm going to have them breathe deeply and relax. I might even use a bell, and I even brought one with me so I can guide the entire your entire, everyone who's listening through this amazing kind of exercise and bringing them into the present moment, and have them be very, very deeply relaxed, have them go through the experience of going over to their friend's house. So I want to reframe that memory so they begin to associate the experience with that time in the past, with that specific house. Then there's a million other things you can do with your fantasy and imagination. I can ask her now, after she has visualized, so she's placed that in the actual house, now imagine going over to another house. Do you see yourself throwing up? And the child will either say yes or no. And then you can play all kinds of games. If you use your intuition and your imagination, and this is the cool stuff about our newest neuroscientific research and some of the things I've put into the special program that I'm offering
great,
to you.
Great, great, yes.
Is that your imagination, whatever you dream up in your frontal lobe imagination, other parts of your brain can't discern between it being an inner fantasy and an outer reality. That's why if you a young child imagines a dragon underneath the bed,
it's as good as real.
It's as good as real.
Uh-huh. So then what you've done is you've kind of disassociated the memory. You called it out, disassociated, reframed into a positive memory, got into a relaxation state, and then forward-paced them into a new memory.
I'm having them call up the old memory, and then I'm embedding it with some humor. I'm making it perhaps more real. I may be asking them, how do you think you would be able to go and spend, I mean, do you really want to go over to another friend's house to sleep? Yes. Well, what might you do in order to not have this problem? And use their imagination. Well, maybe they want to bring an invisible dragon with them. Or use humor and silliness. Now, the reason why I'm not giving specific instructions, because this thing about intuition is very important. Most of the time, if we go to a church, we're given a set of values to believe in. Or we have a set of parents, and they give us a specific set of values. Or we belong to a particular political party, and they gave us a specific set of values. Inside of every human being, there's a place that already has access to its own inner values. So one of the most powerful exercises and strategies we've created is that we found a way to find out what a person's inner religion is, what their own inner politics are, what their own inner belief systems are that aren't imposed upon you by other people. If you assume somebody else's values and they're not consistent with your own, even though you may not know what yours are, you're going to have conflict in your brain. And that's what will generate all kinds of self-doubt and low self-esteem. So one of the easiest ways to help a person get in touch with what's really work for themselves, we ask them one question. What is your deepest, innermost value? But I don't just ask it like this. I need to have the person in a different state of consciousness, because now we're just talking the way we normally do. I want to guide them in. I'll use a bell. You can use relaxation, yawning, and stretching. Now you can access, when you do that, and we can actually see this in the brain, everyday consciousness is this little tiny area in your dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, my favorite word.
Uh-huh.
And it's about the size of your thumb, about the size of your thumbnail, and this one right above each eye. And this is where we do most of our thinking and decision-making from.
Uh-huh.
But if you relax, there are ways that you can expand your consciousness through awareness, meditation exercises, mindfulness, and you can begin to see that more and more of your frontal lobes light up. And what happens is that you begin to get in touch with what's called intuitional awareness. This is awareness. They are thoughts without words.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is very important to know. I mean, I just wrote a whole book called Words Can Change Your Brain. And the most important element of this is that words, of the eight most important elements of communication, words are number eight.
So right, right. So it's body language and all those different ways.
Facial expression is number one. Mm-hmm. Tone of voice is mm-hmm. number two. Body language is number three. The right tone of voice, the rate of your speech. I'm kind of speaking fast and animated right now. This is stimulating everybody's amygdala. There's adrenaline being released. It's really exciting.
When you really know the brain, it is so interesting because it really it uncovers why we do the things we do and how to change them, which I like even better because you get to reconstruct things. You don't have to be a victim to your thoughts any longer, which is really amazing. All right, so what Mark Waldman is talking about today is he has created an offer for the radio station here, and these are MP3 downloads that you will receive for a donation to the station. We're in the middle of our fund drive here at KPFK, and there are 50 downloads, and this is all digital. This is an all-digital product. You download it onto your iPad or your desktop or whatever, your laptop, whatever your device is.
And unfortunately, we're going to have to leave this show. If you're interested, it is Informativo Pacifica. You may be able to find it in your browser. And if you contact 423-4833, I'll try to hook you up with some information about it. But coming up next, it's Bathrob Spears Broadsides, the twice-weekly Civil Rights for the Homeless Search and interviews with me. I'm Robert Norse. Stay with me.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. I want a song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle. It must be packed with social fact, or I won't love you. Sing me of kings and conferences martial. Tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must be tense with common sense, or I won't love you.
And welcome to Bathrob Spears Broadsides. This is, as I mentioned before, twice-weekly show, and we have a shorter version today. It's 2 hours, but that may be quite long enough, or maybe not. I don't know. We'll see. The call-in number here, in case you want to reach me, is 427-3772, 427-3772. That's if you're listening to the show either on the air or on the stream, and you've got some thoughts. I can also receive emails at rnorse3@hotmail.com, and I will try to keep an eye on that as well as an ear on the phone. And I'm opening all that stuff up right now. So let's see what we can do. So a couple things I have scheduled. I'm going to be playing you initially some interviews. that have been kind of piling up over the last week or two. I kind of get ahead of myself, or behind, as the case may be. But there'll be a live interview. I'm expecting to receive a call from Andy Carcero, who is a former resident of the Page Smith Community House and the Paul Lee Loft at the homeless, what I call the Homeless Lack of Services Center. He was one of the people who was lodged there, and I'm going to read a letter from him in about 10 minutes, and then he's, well, maybe 15, he's going to call in and talk about his misadventures there and his concerns about practices at the Homeless Lack of Services Center. I've also sent an email to Phil Kramer, the director, the executive director of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, inviting him to either email in or call in. And, of course, that goes for everybody else, 427-3772, 427-3772, as mentioned before. Then I'm also possibly going to receive a call from activist and sometimes over-vigorous public records requester John Colby, a man who's done a lot of work on this, on issues of malfeasance in government and among private landlords, specifically the John Stewart Company. He and his sister, Pat Colby, apparently, according to an email, are on the streets as of today and have been subjected to a combination of discrimination and harassment, and want to talk about that. I'm also hoping to play kind of a flashback from 2002. I began on the subject either last show or the show before on the issue of the criminalization of the First Amendment on Pacific Avenue in terms of eliminating the right to put on the sidewalk erasable chalk messages about political, social, and artistic messages, or subjects, I should say. This will be a speech by activist Becky Johnson. I call her Beggarbacker Becky because of her long advocacy for poor and homeless people. She's recently been forced out of Santa Cruz by the rents, but her memory is not forgotten, and she's still keeping an eye on things from distant Seaside, may even be listening in on this show, for all I know. Then I'm going to play a brief blurb from the upcoming video, which you can find online, called Out of Sight, Out of Mind. You may remember a rather tumultuous conversation with Big Drum Brent Adams. That's sort of an outdated name for Brent, who I initially ran into as a drummer on Pacific Avenue. And then at 7:30, I hope to have a conversation with Wes White, who is the flagpole community activist from Salinas, actually lives in Monterey, but he spends daily trips over to Salinas to support, and sometimes all overnight, the nearly six-month vigil that's been going on nightly. I should say sleep out every night, not just once a week, as the Freedom Sleepers have done here in Santa Cruz every Tuesday night, and good for them, but every night at Salinas City Hall in order to protest their absurd law that criminalizes homeless people from setting their stuff down on the sidewalk for more than a brief period of time during the day. It's a peculiar, I don't actually even know if it's a time limitation during the day or a thing that's only enforced during the day. So those are kind of what's coming up. And while I'm waiting for all that stuff to come up, I think I'm going to try to roll a little music at you. Let's hear an old familiar tune, and I'll be right back. This is one that I despair of hearing too many old tunes that are a little too familiar. Here's one called Hobo's Lullaby by Woody Guthrie. Let's check this out.
Let me get a McPick, too.
Here's the McPick.
After the mandatory advertising, my apologies, but we'll be getting into the song Past the Hamburgers in just a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Let the towns drift slowly by. Listen to the steel rails humming. That's a hobo's lullaby. Think about tomorrow. Let tomorrow come and go. Tonight you've got a nice warm boxcar, safe from all this wind and snow. I know the police cause you trouble. They cause trouble everywhere. But when you die and go to heaven, you'll find no policeman there. So go to sleep, you weary hobo. Let the towns drift slowly by. Listen to the steel rails humming. That's a hobo's lullaby.
And we have a phone call coming in here, I hope. Hello, can you hear me? Hello?
Oh, yes, I can. Hey, it's James, the jeweler.
Hey, James, you're on free radio, unfortunately. What's cooking?
Hello, everybody. Well, it was an uneventful day on the air, or on the avenue today. But, yeah, I'm just standing outside. Outside the studio.
I gotcha.
Come on in.
Cool. Okay, well, let me open it up for you, and while I'm doing, let's try another little Goody Guthrie number. But that's really Woody Guthrie number. So, don't go away. And listeners, again, if you want to call in with your thoughts, do so, and I'll try to catch the phone, 427-3772.
Take a trip with me in 1913 to Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country. I'll take you to a place called Italian Hall, and the miners are having their big Christmas ball. I'll take you in a door and up a high stairs. Singing and dancing is heard everywhere. I'll let you shake hands with the people you see and watch the kids dance round the big Christmas tree. You ask about work and you ask about pay. They'll tell you they make less than a dollar a day. Working their copper claim, risking their lives. So it's fun to spend Christmas with children and wives. There's talking and laughing and songs in the air. And the spirit of Christmas is there everywhere. Before you know it, you're friends with us all. And you're dancing around and around in the hall. Well, a little girl sits down by the Christmas tree lights to play the piano, so you gotta keep quiet. Here all is fun, you would not realize that the copper ball stug men are milling outside. The copper ball stug stuck their heads in the door. One of them yelled and he screamed, "There's a fire." A lady, she hollered, "There's no such a thing. Keep on with your party, there's no such a thing." A few people rushed and it's only a few. It's just the thugs and the scabs fooling you. A man grabbed his daughter and he carried her down. But the thugs held the door and he could not get out. And then others followed, 100 or more. But most everybody remained on the floor. The gun thugs, they laughed at their murderous joke, while the children were smothered on the stairs by the door. Such a terrible sight I never did see. We carried our children back up to their tree. The scabs outside still laughed at their spree. And the children that died there was 73. The piano played a slow funeral tune. And the town is lit up by a cold Christmas moon. The parents, they cried, and the miners, they moaned. See what your greed for money has done.
And that was Woody Guthrie, The 1913 Massacre. And that song prompted 227 comments on the website where you can find it. I guess if you look for it under Woody Guthrie, 1913 Massacre on YouTube, you can find it there. And it's not a massacre that I'm immediately familiar with. It kind of rings vaguely a familiar chord because it's a lot of brutal attacks on labor organizers happened during this period against the industrial workers of the world and other activists. And if I can, I will try to bring you some more details on it. In fact, maybe I can do that right now. Although, of course, you can find these yourself if you want to go online and look for 1913 Massacre, and let's see what we got here. Okay. There's a lot about the song. This is about something that happened on Christmas Eve in Italian Hall. A war between capital and labor. And in his version of the song, it's a tragedy that took place on December 24th in Calumet's Italian Hall. 500 striking miners and their families had gathered at the hall for a Christmas party that night. The hall could only be accessed by a steep stairway along with a poorly marked fire escape, which could only be reached by climbing out of the windows. The stairway was the only available exit. During the course of the party, somebody shouted fire, although there was no fire. However, people began to panic en masse and rush toward the stairway. While trying to make all their way down the stairs, 73 people were trampled to death, 59 of which were children. And many others apparently sung about the 1913 massacre. Bob Dylan, Cabin Sessions, Alex Campbell, Scarlett O, Jurgen L., and Rambling Jack Elliott, Tom Grimm, Arlo Guthrie, Uncle Dave, there's a whole bunch of folks. And that's all that's really mentioned about the actual event online. So, and what I'm going to do now is, assuming I can seek it out, is I'm having a little trouble doing that, actually. I'm looking through Andy Carcello's emails for his actually rather eloquent account of what has happened to him, which it's a little hard to find directly. There's a very long account of concerns by John Colby addressed to a lot of people, particularly government officials, which isn't terribly helpful for me at this moment, but I'm hoping I can find this. If not, I'm going to ask Andy simply to directly talk about his situation. I'm surprised it's not accessible here. I thought it was clearly available. Ah, here it is. This is a letter, I hope I'm reading the right one, to Claudia Lopez. I'm not quite sure who she is, but he recounts his story. And as I said, this is a man who was a resident at the Homeless Lack of Services Center out at Coral Street that provides a very limited forms of, it isn't even shelter, but if you get into their programs by proving you have a pathway to housing so that they can get government grants for you, or they can chalk you up as part of that Housing First program that they are pushing forward, but not really providing a lot of significant housing for, as far as I know. It's hard to get the stats on this. Phil Kramer, director, you're invited to call in and give us some of the stats. Anyway, this is the letter that Andy wrote. After recovering from open-heart surgery that took place on August 6, 2016, I was finally able to access my mail. There was a letter there regarding a very serious complaint I filed earlier about my treatment as a seriously disabled 59-year-old man. I suffer from cardiac problems, compression fractures, thoracic 5 and 6, herniated lumbar 3 vertebrae, severely damaged left hip joint, and 2 somewhat failed surgical reconstructions of the tibia and fibula of my right leg. I need adequate restroom accommodations, adequate seating arrangements, heating where I sleep at night, safe stairways, and the ability to lay down during the day to ease my chronic pain. The Santa Cruz Homeless Services Loft fails on all above counts, and continued requests for basic accommodations have failed completely. I am on SSI and have a DMV voucher for assisted rent. I am seriously disabled. I do not drink alcohol or smoke cigarettes, and I have never had a single security incident the entire time I have spent at the homeless shelter, and yet I am treated worse than a barnyard animal. On August 1st, 2016, I was put out into the street, suffering from pneumonia, congestive heart failure, my previous cardiac condition, and all my orthopedic problems. I was dying when an ambulance was finally called for me. The reason, according to the Santa Cruz Homeless Services, was for my exiting was nothing more than I had been there too long. It was actually in retaliation for my filing complaints against the terrible living conditions for the disabled there. I complained about the dangerous bathrooms, the stairway, they're tolerating blatant drug and alcohol abuse, no heating, black mold in the showers, ventilation, walls, every service dogs living in the barracks, dog poo everywhere, and transferring in parolees from California prisons because the state pays so much money for them to house them. All of these violations have made living conditions dangerous and filthy for the simply physically disabled, like myself. We are being stored like barnyard animals in the SCHC loft for money. And now Dominican Hospital exited me to the streets on August 10th, 4 days after open-heart surgery to replace a severely defective heart valve. I am depending upon your help. Santa Cruz Homeless Shelter's phone number, 458-6020. Director of the Loft, Jordan Boyer. Director of the facility, Phil Kramer. Sincerely, Andrew F. Carcello. And he gives his cell phone number. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to call Andy and see if we can reach him on the phone and have him comment further on any new developments. This letter was written yesterday, so I don't expect there has been much in the way of new developments, but let's see what we got.
We're sorry. Your call cannot be completed as dialed. Please check the number and dial.
And I'm having a little problem, as you can hear, getting through. Let's try one more time. And we're giving it another try here. It sounds better. We may be able to reach our man in just a moment. I wish we had a second phone line coming into the studio.
Robert?
Hey, Andy, you are on Free Radio.
Robert?
Welcome. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Robert. How are you doing?
Very good, very good. Say hello to your fans out there and your foes.
And my foes. Well, hello to everyone out there. I'm here to clarify a letter I sent not too long ago.
Yeah, I just read your letter to Claudia Lopez. Who exactly is Claudia Lopez?
She's someone, an investigator from the Justice Department. And she seems very adamant about investigating these allegations.
Wow. When did you last...
They're very straightforward. They're very direct violations of the law.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't subjective. You know, this is factual.
Uh-huh. When did you last talk to her?
That was yesterday, I believe.
And... Are you currently have lodging, or are you outside? What's your situation?
No, now I do. You know, August 1st, they put me outside with congestive heart failure, pneumonia. They say I was having a mild heart attack. They know full well that I have a birth defect in my heart, and of course I have all these severe orthopedic problems. I would have died out there on August 1st if I hadn't got to Dominican Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's one of my beats.
Now, how long were you out on the street there?
August 6th I had open heart surgery. 4 days later, Dominican Hospital walks me out into the lobby. I refused to go to this Salinas nursing home out in the outskirts of Salinas, and so they got very angry at me. On the 10th, I get walked out. 4 days after open heart surgery, I spent the first week on the floor of a friend's house.
Now, why did you refuse to go to the Salinas nursing home?
Well, because I feel like it was a deliberate action to isolate me in Salinas. By this time, you know, I full well knew or felt that these people were out to hurt me. I mean, you know, unequivocally, they physically and emotionally hurt me on the first, and that was intentional, and that was intentional to cause great bodily harm or my death. That's the way I looked at it.
Right, but the people, the people.
So these same individuals, an extension of Santa Cruz Housing Services, is Dominican Hospital case managers, and they're telling me that there's no place in the Santa Cruz area for me, but the only place they can put me in is in Salinas. I later find out that one of the case managers labeled me as a problem person, okay? Now, let's visit that. I have never had an incident in going on 6 years at Santa Cruz shelter.
Okay, wait, whoa, hang on a second. Before we go any further,
sure.
Let me just ask a few questions.
Yeah.
Actually... So the case manager who wanted you to go to the Salinas nursing home, you think was connected directly with the Homeless Lack of Services Center, as I call them?
Yes, I do.
And why do you say that? What was her or his connection?
Well, because, I mean, they're coming up with this business of my reputation of being a problem. Problem causer over there, a problem causer with them, you know, because I'm refusing to go to Watsonville, I'm refusing to go to Salinas. This becomes, according to them, my M.O.
Now, what's this about refusing to go to Watsonville? Who offered you a place in Watsonville?
Well, quite a while ago, as I wrote on Facebook, I felt that two case managers from Santa Cruz Homeless Services were simply trying to strong-arm me into one of these Watsonville places. You know, after informing them months ahead of time of my situation, you know, the only thing they could do was dump me into Watsonville. So what they did was isolate me in the back garden of Paige Smith and begin to tell me that if I didn't find a place in 60 days, I was going to be put out into the street.
Before you go any further, what do you mean by isolate? Isolated you in the back gardens of Paige Smith. First of all, explain to listeners, what is Paige Smith and how did that happen? What is that about?
Okay, Paige Smith is a trailer community in the rear of the shelter, okay? It's a transitional housing facility. There's a garden area back there, okay? Now, one of the case managers at that time is Michael Carballo. I had an appointment with Michael at 11 a.m. When he didn't show up 20 minutes later, which is typical for Michael, I just went back to work in the garden where I'm always working, okay?
Mm-hmm.
About 20 minutes after that, Mr. Joe Price and Michael Carballo come back there and begin to talk to me about going to Watsonville, whether it's the Stag or the Roosevelt or the Wall Street. And I clearly told Michael months ahead of time, I'm not going to Watsonville. Can you please work something out in the Santa Cruz area? Especially considering I've never caused a problem here at this homeless shelter. I've worked over 3,000 hours here. Let me continue here until you can find a decent place for me.
Let me ask you the obvious question, though, here, man. This is the question that maybe listeners are maybe going to be asking. How long had you stayed at Page Smith prior to this?
Okay. 35 months.
And what is the average stay or the mandated stay? I understood it was 6 months or 9 months or something like that.
Okay. The first is 18 months, and then you can get a six-month extension. So 24 months is the maximum.
Gotcha.
So Andy Carcella was there 35 months, okay?
So you were over by you were over by 11 months?
By 11 months.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah. You know, and it wasn't because people didn't like me. I mean, all the directors there, I had letters of commendation and whatnot, you know, they started talking about a permanent place for me and whatnot. And then, of course, when Shelley McKintrick blew all four of those grants and they had the investigations, here Andy is over, you know, 11 months here.
Now, let me pause for a second and explain to people. Shelley McKittridge was the director prior to Phil Kramer at the Homeless Lack of Services Center.
Right.
And it was under her, some would say, mismanagement that grants were mismanaged that resulted in the serious closure of a lot of the services there, limited as they already were.
That's exactly what happened. I mean, that was the straw, I think, that broke the camel's back over there.
But getting back to this question, and the obvious question that a naive person might say is, hey, look, Andy, you were there for 18 months. You got an extension to 24 months. You got an extension to 36 or 35 months. You said 36 months. I'm not sure which.
Yeah.
And so what about those people who want to get in and take your place and that sort of thing? I mean, that would be the obvious question that people would say.
Well, okay. Let's go back here. Okay. I didn't get an 11-month extension. It just happened that I was there over 11 months. In that 11 months, I mean, nobody said, oh, God, you're going to stay 35 months. It just seems like everybody forgot about me. Okay? So I'm rolled into thinking, well, I mean, no, you know, if they want me to stay here, I've lost everything. I'm doing all this work, and I'm seriously disabled. it seemed fine to me. And, of course, you know, I seriously, and everybody knows this that's listening, I've worked at least 3,000 hours there, hard hours. Don Lane knows that, and everybody damn well knows that.
And Don Lane, for those who don't know.
I feel I returned their housing.
I got you.
The work that I've done.
But,
okay?
I mean,
I didn't know. Wait a minute, Robert. I did not expect them. I mean, if this thing fell apart, okay, I understood that. You know, but I thought they would at least have the professional decency to find me a decent place to live in the Santa Cruz area after everything that I've done for them. Not to mention the fact that the accident that happened my first year in the garden cost me 2 years of my life, and that definitely affected my housing because they could not find a place where I could wash out the staph wound that I got from their damn showers. I mean, we just could not find a living arrangement for that. One of the directors, Sarah Peters, took me around here. You know, the Palomar had public bathrooms down the hall. I couldn't wash this giant wound off down there. I needed a first floor arrangement at that time, and they just couldn't find a place for me. But once again, this was because of an accident that occurred there while I was working there in a front garden. You know, geez. I expected just decent decent treatment as another human being that worked hard for these people.
Okay, well, let me interrupt. Andy, let me interrupt.
Sure,
I mean, I have to agree with you. I mean, you have to understand, I'm sympathetic to all this, and I'm trying to be devil's advocate here because, you know, we're trying to, you know, look at it from all sides.
Yeah, go ahead, Robert.
I mean, these are all important considerations you're raising, but one has to ask, you know, these... rather, you know, one might even say criminally limited facilities that are being provided for people. Is it, I mean, when you get into the Page Smith Community House, I don't know what the nature of the contract is that you sign. It was supposed, you know, it presumably it's for 18 months, and then, you know, you move on to something else. And and if you are disabled, does that, both in everybody's case as well, mean, oh, you can stay until the disability is resolved? Or does that mean that, you know, that they have to find you some accommodation somewhere, even if it's in a distant city? See, I mean, this is what someone would say looking at this.
Yeah, well, the way I look at it is, what the hell do they get paid for? They get paid for finding you housing, okay? In my case, I don't drink alcohol, I don't smoke cigarettes, I got this wonderful reputation going on, I'm on SSI, and for 6 years I sat there and never got an application presented to me until the very end, okay? And so I'm looking at it as like, okay, you guys, you know, what are you getting paid for?
I hear you.
You know, they pick up a government check, get off your butts, and do your work.
Right, but of course, what they're paid for, of course, is to warehouse you for a period of time, supposedly look for housing, and then dump you out and find and warehouse another group of 40 people, 50 people for another 18 months.
Okay.
Isn't that their system? Isn't that what they do?
Well, that's their system, and that's another thing that I'm criticizing here. And I'm also saying, well, if you guys are going to go out and target disabled people, and that's what they're doing, they're targeting voucher people, you don't get a voucher unless you're disabled, well, then you damn well better accommodate their disabilities according to the law.
Now, how successful, Andy, of course, how successful have they been in accommodating others? Have you got any sense of, let's say, first of all, what's the population of Page Smith, or what was it when you were there?
It's about 40 people. I mean, you can always fill those rooms.
And
you know, of course, there are a series of times I've seen trailers go empty for months.
What's your sense of how many of those people they found housing for? If you know.
Boy, they have dumped a lot of people into these places in Washingtonville. Now, wait, I got to qualify this. Damn it, Robert. I'm getting... Okay. For some people, those Watsonville places may be great. Okay?
Explain what the Watsonville places are for folks. You mentioned Stagg, Roosevelt, Wall Street.
To me, and I may have this wrong, but to me, they seem to be run by Encompass overall. Okay? Hmm. Now, they're the places that accept regularly Section 8 people. In fact, there's an entire system of Section 8 housing that's built around the Wall Street, the Stagg, the Roosevelt, and Washingtonville.
What are these places?
Now, I've talked to people that have stayed there.
What are these places? What are these places? Are they hotels?
They're kind of like large hotel complexes.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
They're very much like a hotel.
Uh-huh.
It's four stories, you know, kind of places with rooms and whatnot.
Have you visited them and seen them yourself?
At one time. And I must say that the apartment I was taken to was fully furnished in Watsonville. I mean, it was totally unprepared to kind of put me there. But it was nice. It was clean. It was, you know, it was great if you wanted to live in a place like that.
And what was wrong with that environment? What was wrong with that you found?
Well,
both for you and for maybe someone else.
Well, okay. I mean, this is what I'm hearing. This is my sense of it. Okay, you gather people that are having, you know, drug and alcohol problems, that are mentally ill. A lot of them have a criminal background. And you concentrate them in these housing complexes, you know, throw in some bed bugs, throw in some heroin and methamphetamine and some Mexican gangs, and, you know, you got some of these places going on. You know, I'm not just willing to go there after, you know, my parents had a pharmacy there for 60 years, My mother's father had a 700-acre dairy up here. I grew up here. I want to go back to work. I don't drink. I don't have a drug problem. You know, and I don't want to be sent off into Washington. It'll just rot away in a room.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And now, other people are content with that. I am not. You know, but the price that I've paid for this has been tremendous.
Is it your feeling? I hear you, and we read the letter, and you've been even talking more pertinently about all the different, you know, more specific details and abuses you feel that you've been undergone there. But what would you? My purpose as an advocate or an observer even of the situation is to consider the average person who comes into this situation. Is the average person? I tend to feel with you. Yeah, you know, demand what you should be entitled to. Demand appropriate redress. I'm all for that. But do you think that this is a reasonable expectation on entering the program for anybody who enters that program in terms of the facilities they actually have and claim to be giving you? What's your thought about that?
Well, let's get down to the basics here. What the mayhem... when you store people in a place like this, what has happened down there, and the mayhem down there, and the confusion down there? Okay, this is what I want to talk about. Okay, there's a mixture of disabled people down there, but homelessness now means a lot of different things.
Now, by down there, by down there, you mean in Watsonville or at the Page Smith?
No, at the Santa Cruz facility. This is what I can talk about.
Right, at Page Smith.
My experience. Okay. Page Smith and the law. Okay.
And explain to folks what the difference is between those two.
Okay, Page Smith, you're staying in a trailer, typically five people to a trailer. Okay, you're sharing two bathrooms, one kitchen. All right.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is, of course, you have to have very stable people when you stick them in a tin can like that, sharing these facilities. And of course, they're not stable people. They're medically and mentally compromised individuals, most of whom are practicing drug and alcohol abuse. I mean, it's crazy over there.
That was true
that is why they have to call the police so often.
And that was true in your trailer situation when you were in the Page Smith Community House.
We had the show trailer. Trailer number four was where they showed, you know, all the guests, because we got along. We got along without a toilet. We didn't fight over toilet paper. It was marvelous. We were together 3 years because we stuck together 3 years. And we had those individuals that could compromise, that are socially, you know, adept. Now, the trailer situation around us was crazy. I mean, there were people selling meth. There were people going crazy on alcohol. There were fisticuffs between women. And it was tolerated. And this was one criticism I had of the harm reduction philosophies of Shelley McIndrick. You know, I saw people go into fisticuffs a half a dozen times and still stay there, okay? Now, that was Page Smith. That still is Page Smith. All right? Now, you got the loft going on.
But before you go to the loft, let me go back, stay with Page Smith for a minute. Are you suggesting that you think the folks that this was happening to, or the people who were nearby would have preferred to have the fisticuff folks and the folks who were regularly using removed for those particular purposes? And do you think the new people would have been any different? I mean, I guess is the question.
Yeah, here is my idea on that. Yeah, in fact, there was a standard joke for years going around about Shelley's harm reduction philosophy, causing more harm than it ever prevented. Okay, and that was out of the community. You know, I mean, geez, yeah, the community wanted to see these seriously, and there are only a few violent individuals removed from the population somehow, okay? So, now, when I went into Page Smith originally, I was drug tested, okay? And that included marijuana. And you had to pass the drug test to get into Page Smith. That was eradicated. Now, we had no problem with drug testing and filling up those trailers, all right? So it just brings into question, and we had a much better population before the renovation, before the new policy.
When was the renovation?
What was that, several years ago? Three, 4 years ago? Mm-hmm. Robert, I kind of lost all track of time over there.
It's okay.
Okay. But, I mean, you know, it brings up the question, do you drug test people into housing? I don't know. It was my experience. We got a much better population of people in there. But that isn't to say it was zero tolerance. You know, we knew, you know, I work hand in hand with some of these directors. We knew people were using, you know, off and on. People were drinking off and on. But it was never like it is now. You know.
Now, was that because of a change in policy under Shelley McKittridge?
Yeah, I believe so.
And what about the policy under Phil Kramer now?
Boy, I don't know very much about Mr. Kramer. He doesn't even say hello to me or any other homeless people. I mean, and there is a very much of a void between the hands-on workers that handle the homeless people and then the administration. I mean, there's just a chasm between the two of them.
Have you had much contact with the people still in Page Smith?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, up until the end, up until I was walked out of there.
Well, what's your sense? Because Phil Kramer's been there now for almost a year. Actually, he has been. First he was temporary, then he was permanent. What do they think, based on your contacts?
Okay, Kramer, to me, is making the place look as good as possible to get whatever money he can into the place. As far as actually helping the living conditions of the people in the loft, or addressing the problems over at Page Smith, the actual living problems, you know, the quality of life, the air, the mildew, you know, the safety of the individual. I mean, he's non-existent. You know, man, I call it the way I see it.
Now, these are the reports you've gotten from people who are still in Page Smith.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, this isn't just Andy Carcello here. You know, I mean, and frankly, I mean, how I was treated and how I was thrown out has basically happened to other individuals, and it has hurt these other individuals terribly.
Now, have you talked to any attorneys or legal advisors who might suggest to you whether
they're... Yeah, I'm one of those, kind of a primary witness here in a class action lawsuit.
What is the class action lawsuit seeking?
Well, I don't know exactly what it's seeking. What I wanted to do is just rattle this entire institution down there. I want someone to come in from the Justice Department and look at how they're treating elderly disabled people.
Now, John and Pat Colby have been trying to help you do this, particularly John, by writing letters. Do you have any comments about their assistance?
Well, wish it was more effective, because I'm out here on my butt right now. You know, right now, the ministries have been wonderful to me. I'm very supportive of me.
The ministries meaning?
A small group of people there. I mean, I got handed. I don't get dogma. I just get very sincere caring from the various individuals in these churches. Hmm. So I have nothing but good to say about it. Hmm. But as far as anyone, you know, from the left or the right here stepping up and giving me a bed to sleep in, it was non-existent, you know. Everybody gave me a lot of verbal support, but nobody gave me a place to sleep.
Are you now looking for a place specifically on a short-term basis, and we can put out a plea? You can even put out a plea for a long
time. After open-heart surgery, I'm still like this. You have my chest fused and whatnot, and I need a place to just stay. And I'm a real decent, nice guy, you know, that's never causing any kind of problem. I mean, geez, you know, I don't know, Robert. I could use a place, man.
Mm-hmm.
I really could.
Well, we've talked partially. Well, of course, how can people get in touch with you if they want to contact you? And they can also contact me, and I can then put them in touch with you if you don't want to give out direct info, whichever you prefer.
Well, I'd love to, no, I don't want you to be bothered too much. They could contact me on my phone here. It's 831-332-2717. Or even better right now for me is email. And that's Andy Carr, all lowercase, A-N-D-Y-C-A-R, at sbcglobal.net. And I would love to have a decent place to stay. You know, I do great garden work. I'm very good with domestic chores. You know, I don't drink. I don't have any pets or, you know, unwanted people around. I just need a place.
So give me, again, it's 332-2717, and the email address, again, is...
is Andy Carr, A-N-D-Y-C-A-R, SDAR at sbcglobal.net.
Okay,
and so, I would love a place of somebody.
Can you provide any money, or is this pretty going to
help? Yeah, sure I can. Sure I can. Getting SSI right now, I'll pay $600 a month easy from the SSI. I do have a DMV voucher, which is good, to $419 a month. You know, Santa Cruz Housing Authority has really helped me and really stood behind me in this. I mean, they're not standing, you know, square up against transitional housing down there and Coral Street. But, you know, Mark Failure and Jenny Panetta have been very good to me as far as extending my voucher and trying to get me into a place, man.
So,
you know, this is another thing I can't understand. You know, they actually, from what I understand, called Phil Kramer and said, you know, could you give him a couple more weeks to work out? You know, I'm coming into trust money and all this other stuff. You know, could you give him a couple more weeks to work all this stuff out? And they just would not do it.
So we don't really know much about this trust stuff, and I don't know if you, meaning this is some sort of financial money you may be coming into. Do you want to talk about that, or should we leave that?
Yeah, no, well, no, that's cool. I just want to let people know that, yeah, this is another element here. You know, I told Michael Carballo in the very beginning, look, maybe we shouldn't start this from, you know, thing with a voucher, because there's a time limit here.
Michael Carballo was who?
Yeah. He was a case manager for transitional housing over on Coral Street.
And he was the fellow that wanted to put you in the Watsonville facilities that you felt were bad news.
No experience with DMV vouchers, mm-hmm. which are different than the other vouchers. And, you know, I told him right from the beginning, maybe, you know, please wait and let's see what's going on here. So, yeah, I'm coming in with some money January 2017, and, it's going to affect my life for the better, and but how I take on this money is complicated. You know, I want to maintain my disability, especially after the heart surgery, but, of course, I'm entitled to my family's inheritance. So, and there's a way to work this out. It's complicated and whatnot. And I just asked them for a little more time, and they wouldn't give it to me. You know, I mean, they were very, I don't know, what do you say, adamant about throwing me out?
Bureaucratic, perhaps, as
yeah.
well. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. We've actually talked about, you know, a placement. Tell us a bit about Paul Lee, because that's another facility. It used to be a shelter that you could get in onto the waiting list for. Now it's a closed facility. You have to be in a pathway to housing, and it's considerably different than Page Smith, right?
Well, yeah, it is considerably different from Page Smith in some way. You know, but see, this is one of my criticisms. It's not just voucher people that are coming in there anymore. You know, we're getting parolees from the state prison institutions passed in there. Okay, now think about this. You grab somebody out of prison, and 9 times out of 10 they got a drug history. You bring them into the shelter where meth and heroin is just rampant everywhere right now, and then most of the time they meet their friends or their peer group. And, you know, dollars to donuts within no time.
Let me ask you, though, about the Paul Lee Loft. What is it? How is it distinguished? I know, but I want you to explain from Page Smith, and what are its problems? You're certainly talking about one of them in your perspective, but tell us a little bit more about the day-to-day, how it works there.
Well, okay. Get up in the morning at 6 o'clock. You got 1 hour to kind of clean up, pack up, and then you're put outside at 7, and you're not allowed back into your bunk area or to lay down from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. Okay, then the loft is open back up, and you can go back to your bunk. It's a bunk-type situation, a bunker house, you know, situation, where you got 30 men on one side and I think about 15 women on the other. You know, it's a very open sleeping arrangement. People are right on top of each other.
Literally.
Literally. I mean, literally.
I mean, you're talking about bunk beds.
Literally. So, I mean, and then, you know, we have mentally ill people that are mixed in there. Before I left, we had an Alzheimer patient that it was so bad off. He had sundowners at night. He didn't know where he was. He was in an immense amount of fear all the time. You know, we have people in wheelchairs downstairs. It's not a wheelchair facility. You know, you get this mixture. And, of course, all the time you have various individuals abusing drugs and alcohol. So it's mayhem.
How long were you there in the Pauley loft?
Got over a year this time.
So
you know, the first time I did about a year and a half, it was a 30-day program, and I got all the extensive for the work. And because of my medical problems, and I'm the only person that they've ever given those kinds of extensions to, you know.
In the Pauley loft.
Of course, I was the only person that ever renovated the entire garden, you know, the first year I was there.
So for your first few years were in Page Smith and then in the Pauley loft, or vice versa?
No, the first couple of years was actually over in the 30-day loft program under one of the strictest loft managers ever, Nancy Liu. And then, because of the wound I got from the accident that occurred in the front garden out there, it eventually got so big, you know, I had to, and deep, I had to wash it out every morning. And it kept getting infected over in the loft. You know, I was admitted to Dominican Hospital 5 times for IV antibiotics, you know, during a couple of years I fought to keep my leg on. But anyway, I finally was transferred into Page Smith just to take care of the wound and wash it out every morning. And to keep it from getting infected and all whatnot.
And how long were you there in Page Smith?
35 months.
And then back again to the Pauley loft?
Yeah, back again to the Pauley loft.
For a year?
For about a year now, yeah.
And how had the Pauley loft changed after in your renewed time there?
You know, in a way it's a little different, but, you know, it's the same damn animal. I mean, we have sicker people there, I think, but as far as the craziness I've seen go on there from time to time, the injection of drugs up in the law, people, you know, coming in, street sheets to the wind, I mean, that's still going on. That's still going on just as much as it ever did.
And so, is anybody else taking the kind of stand you are in terms of, for example, rejecting the Watsonville facilities, or
there are other. I don't know how they're being treated, but I know there are other people who are doing the same thing.
Has anybody come together with you? You know, let's say a petition to the management to say, hey, these conditions have to change. I mean, it sounds like now you're going to the Department of Justice and they're talking to you. But was there any previous? Not just your attempt, because you obviously have been trying them. I've been reading your correspondence with the management officials. But has anybody else joined you in this fight? Or are they afraid to do so, or are they just not interested?
Most are afraid to do so. You know, others just, you know, don't have the capability of doing it. You know, a lot of people go over there. I mean, when they pulled all these people out of Page Smith for being there too long and stuck them over in the loft, a lot of them just couldn't handle the stairs and everything, and not being able to lay down from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Now, it should be said that the loft has stairs, but Page Smith does not. And what are the other differences? The Page Smith has a lot more bathroom facilities than the loft, or what's the deal there?
Yeah, and definitely if you have a disability, it's much easier to attend in Page Smith than it ever is in the loft. You know, the mere fact they lock you out from the ability to lay down from 7 in the morning to 4 p.m., I mean, is terrible. Christ, I'm a chronic pain patient. You know, I mean, I've got compression fractures on my back. I've got reconstructions on my leg that could have turned out better. And not being able to lay down during the day. And then, of course, you know, what does that do? It drives a lot of people to use drugs.
Now, has that always... Andy, been the case both in your earlier experience in the Pauley loft and then again, you know, in your new time? And I understand Page Smith, you were allowed to be there during the day, right?
Well, I went through the renovation there where they transferred all the people from Page Smith into the loft, and we had 24/7 access to the bunks. And it can be done. I mean, they just had another person working there to oversee it. So that went on for 4 months. So I experienced the loft when you could have access to your bunk during the day, and along with a lot of other people. It can be done, you know, certainly, and it can be done safely. Well, I've seen it done both ways. But right now, it's from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. you're locked out.
Was that the case beforehand as well?
Yeah, it was. It was. It was just that short period of time during the renovation that they opened up 24/7 access to pump.
And are people allowed to stay on the grounds of the area, or are they essentially told to leave the area?
Well, now this is what we got one day. Of course, you know, it's very uncomfortable to even try and find a place to sit there, you know. So, and sometimes it's impossible because everybody's attempting to lay down on the these wooden benches. But anyway, one evening at a Monday night meeting, we get from the director, Jordan Boyer, that can't you guys go downtown and sit, you know, can't you go someplace else during the day? kind of makes you feel unwanted.
When was this? When did this meeting happen?
Oh, there's Monday night meetings over there from time to time with the people in the loft. You know, you're trying with new rules and various issues and problems that occur, you know, and basically we were told, can't you people go someplace else?
When was this? When was this? A year ago?
Oh, I don't know, probably about 4 or 5 months ago.
And did people, you know, then leave and go downtown?
People got angry. You know, I stood up right then and there and said something to her, you know, about treating disabled people like dirt, you know. But, man, everybody was upset about that one. I mean, for Christ's sakes, I mean, we've got some really sick people out there that can't even walk downtown, let alone, you know, I mean, and then not to give them a decent place to sit down during the day? Come on, you guys. I mean, come on, you guys.
What's your feeling? Were you a part of this whole program before they built the fence and set up the guard gates and that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've seen it run both ways.
What's your feeling? Has that been an improvement?
Okay. See, this is it with me. What are you intending to do? I mean, now it's run like a jail. Okay, now it's run like a prison, minimum security prison facility. Do they have justification to do that? I don't know. You got to ask yourself some damn hard questions there. I mean, is this where transitional housing is going? Is this what you guys want? I mean, you know, you're not educating anybody here. You're not putting them back to work. You know, you're not doing anything constructive with them, and you're damn well running a jail. You know, so it's like, what are you guys doing here? On top of that, I've seen these policies and procedures put into play, and they've killed people. They've maimed people because of this.
Explain what policies and procedures do this.
Huh?
Explain which specific policies and procedures you're talking about and who got maimed.
Well, okay, here's one for you. Michael Todd. Michael Todd was severely ill, had agoraphobia, and was just in this anxiety state with serious heart problems, okay? So they give him, you know, when this investigation goes through, they hand Michael a 60-day eviction notice. Now, I personally, and I have emails that I wrote to them about this, I personally went to Shelley and I said, you know, you got to back off on this guy because you're going to kill him, okay? Well, about 10 days later, he has a massive heart attack and dies in our trailer. Ed is there giving him CPR with these other guys. And, Michael just passed away. Now, there's a whole question 45 minutes before then. The ambulance service came down, you know, said they did an AKG on his heart, told him he was just having an anxiety attack. They took off. 15 minutes later, he's on the floor dying of a massive coronary. What happened there is anybody's question. So, of course, the ambulance service had to come back and picked up a dead body. All right. So there's one example of that. There's another example of that with what they did to me as an individual. But here's another good one for you. A gentleman that had an MS, okay? And I'm not going to use his name. I knew him. I used to help him take showers for a period of time. Okay, they didn't like what he was doing. They didn't like who he was. Okay, they forced him into a car. 2 weeks later, he gets his legs amputated because there's no circulation there. And he's sitting in a car. Now, you just got to ask yourself, you know, is this right? I mean, it's like they're a law unto themselves down there. They've never heard of the American Disabilities Act. And it's like, if you aggravate these people, I mean, look what happened to me. They will kill you. They will throw you out and facilitate your death. Okay? I have no doubts about that anymore. I was warned about that. I thought it was poppycock, but then they damn well did it to me. So...
Sure, now, let's be more specific about this, because you, as I understand it, they kicked you out on August 1st, and then you were out several days sleeping in front of the homeless lack of services center?
Yeah, I was dying out there.
And you stayed out there as a form of protest?
I stayed out there a couple of days. I think it was 2 days before I just was laying against the front gate by the kiosk there, and I asked for an ambulance.
And were other people out there in a similar situation, or were you alone?
I was alone in this instance, but, I mean, similar things have happened to other individuals.
The reason I ask is, in the past, I've noticed, it was some months ago, that there was sort of almost an encampment outside the Homeless Lack of Services Center. People were sleeping there.
They have kind of done away with that. You know, and somehow they really keep that area cleared out now.
And did you find any harassment from police while you were out there during those 2 or 3 days? Were you there? You were there throughout the entire day?
No, I did not. I did not personally have any problems with the police. I had no contact with them whatsoever.
And they didn't come over and say, "Where are you hanging about? You're in the no impact zone. You're impacting us." Blah blah blah.
No.
Now is there a no impact zone? Is that still in effect out there, as far as you know?
Well, it doesn't look that way to me. You know, I went back the other day, 2 or 3 days ago, and I went back early before shower. So I picked up the trash in the Granite area. Granite has a little truck fixing area that's kind of next door to the fabrication place that's next door to the shelter. Anyway, I mean, it looked terrible. I mean, there's garbage everywhere. And I remember my first year there, there was an impact area. And we had volunteers that went out and cleaned up, you know, several blocks around there. That isn't happening anymore. God, it looks terrible. It just looks terrible. You know, it looks like a ghetto, man. It looks like some, you know, low income place in Detroit or some damn thing.
You know, I'm just wondering, I mean, that sounds like a good thing to have people. Were these volunteers or was this forced labor?
No, it was volunteers, and we got fed a meal, and you know, we're doing the work, a lot of people enjoyed it, you know. All that's gone.
Are people in the Pauli Laughter basement expected to do work in order to stay there?
No, not anymore. That used to be a pretty hardcore criteria, you know, when you'd fill stuff out on a chart, which was that. But now that they put so many disabled people up there, you know, it's just the opposite. You're not expected to do anything. Frankly, I think that's much, much worse.
So there's no ping pong, no sauna, no shuffleboard going on?
No, it's just a terrible place to stay. And they do that intentionally. You know, and they'll tell you they do that intentionally because they don't want you to get comfortable there. Well, that's really neat, you know. You might do that with some hoodlums, but you damn well don't do that with disabled elderly people. I mean, what the hell kind of philosophy is that? It's like Stalag 17 there.
Is there much of a community between the clients, even though they're in a wretched situation? Is there much solidarity between them?
No. You know, you're dealing with people that are very, very sick. Probably could... have a few more years of an education. You know, a lot of them are abusing some kind of drugs or alcohol. I mean, they're easy targets to be exploited, okay? You know, that's been another issue here. I mean, it's just they're easy people to take advantage of. And that's what's been happening here in my book.
And your current situation is you have a friend's couch or floor to sleep on at the moment?
Well, I'm sleeping with a church. It's a different church every night.
Yeah, this is the Association of Faith Communities?
Yeah, mm-hmm. With Debbie Bates and whatnot. And I like them, Robert. I like these people.
Yeah,
I'll save my butt.
Well, that's good, because I've heard others who are saying that they won't let people go out for the night to do political work or to public events and so forth.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's that. I mean, there's a lot of improvements that could be made here. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they wanted to really bring on a shelter or housing, whatever situation, that's, and they're talking about that. You know,
but it's a very limited number. It's a limited number of people, right? We're talking 20 people at most. Right?
Yeah, we're talking 20 people. Yeah.
And how long have you been with them? How long you been with them?
Just a couple weeks.
And how did you happen to get into that? Did you yourself?
It was Brian Wilkes who saw me on Facebook getting thrown out, and I was in desperate need of a place. He stepped up and said, hey, you know, he's involved with the ministries, and, you know, he had the floor to stay on. You know, they came and got me after, you know, Dominican walked me out to the lobby. I had no place to go, and they came and got me, man. You know, which I wasn't a great, it was, you know, the best of places right after open heart surgery, but it's damn well saved my life.
So when you get your inheritance, you will be funding a new program for the AFC.
I'm going to look, you know.
I'm kidding here, of course.
No, but I'm serious. You know, damn well, I'm 59 years old, Robert. I've been involved in this stuff a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, I just want to make sure people are fed and have a decent, safe place to stay. I want to see people go back to work, damn it. You know, if they can, if they want to, you know. I don't want anybody forced into work. I'm not talking about that. You know, and I want to see, like, women and children first. You know, especially with women, you know, I just want the basic, decent things. The way I was raised, you know, that's, you just don't treat people badly, you know, like this. And you take care of the people that are sick, and you give them a place to stay, and you put them back to work, and you give them a second chance. And there's people out here that deserve that, you know. Not everybody. And I wish I could fix everybody, but I can't.
So, Andy, on the program about, forgive me for interrupting, I'm just kind of pushing this along here.
No, I'm sorry. No,
you're doing good. You're doing good. I had on the show Brent Adams, who's trying to set up a sanctuary village and wants to have a warming program because they haven't even got a winter shelter program planned, as you probably know, for the winter. There's no armor and so forth. I mean, it's, you know, it's, I don't,
a lot of people are worried.
I've never had much good to say about the armory or, even for that matter, the Association of Faith Communities, that you're finding a lifesaver, you know. But what I'm wondering is he views this this program that Phil Kramer is running, what I call the Homeless Lack of Services Center, as a kind of sort of a shill for the Smart Solutions 180 Housing First, and a destruction of shelter as shelter. And I have two questions for you. One is, do you think that's accurate? And two, should they be given the kind of serious criticisms you have of the shelter program under previous management and now? What should be done at the Homeless Lack of Services Center? In other words, you're suddenly in charge. What do you do?
Okay. Well, the first thing I would do is I would look at the conditions, the basic living conditions of the lot. I think I would go after the ventilation and make sure these people have heating during the wintertime coming up here. And I'd take a look at the mold situation and whatnot. Also, in the bathrooms, let me tell you, I'm disabled, right? And the damn bars for disability bars, you know, getting on the toilet, they're a godsend when they're done right. There's not one disability bar in that damn bathroom that is done right that has helped me sit on the toilet. Okay, things like that. All right, I think they should really take a hardcore look at how many times they should tolerate people's erratic behavior, especially if these people are under the influence. I think there should be a hardcore policy that says, man, you come in two times, three sheets to the wind, you need to leave here, okay? That's not being done here. Also, this business of mixing parolees with just disabled people, I don't think that's a very damn good idea, okay? Also, if you're, you know, if you're going to go out there and get disabled people that are really in pain and whatnot, they need to lay down during the day. So they need to figure out how to open up these bunks so people can lay down during the day. You know, man, when you're in a lot of pain, you can't just sit outside. Those are the basic things.
Well, they have a $3 million budget, as I understood, or they did a year ago. I'm not, entirely accurate on that. And, you know, they claim that they lost, I don't know, $300,000 or $400,000 of it. So they cut off the meals to folks outside. I've been very critical of that. But you may not have been. You may have think that it was a bad idea to allow the homeless community generally to come inside and eat there twice a day. What's your feeling?
Well, okay. Okay, this is the issue. I've worked hundreds of hours in the cafeteria. Okay, so now you gotta feed people. You feed people off the street. They're a rough crowd, and let me tell you, it's different feeding them than feeding people in the loft. You get a lot of erratic behavior. You get. I had to clean up four trash bathrooms, and we finally had to lock the bathrooms up. The last time this guy gets in there for 2 hours, spreads feces all over the wall. Okay, those are the kind of things that go on if you take on people off the street. At the same time, you got to ask yourself some basic questions here. Do we starve them? Do we not feed them? I mean, I think we should kind of bite the bullet and feed people, you know, off the street. I really think we should do that. Now, I don't want to start inviting people in here from all over California or all over the United States to be taken care of in the homeless shelter. But we have a population of people out there in the street. Most of them are really crazy. God, we need to feed them. We need to figure this out so we can feed them at least. You know, and I think we need to do the bathrooms and whatnot. Yeah, you know, Robert, it's not pretty sometimes. Homeless shelters has never been pretty.
So, you know, you've been there for a number of years. You were there when they were feeding people regularly. Was it significantly better or worse when people were being fed who came from the outside or not?
It was a little rougher, but it wasn't terrible. You know, when we were doing the armory this last year. The cook and everybody else said, the rougher crowd, it's rougher, blah, blah, blah. But we got through it. And with more security people monitoring these people after they ate, making sure, hey, you pick your stuff up and you leave, it was well managed, you know?
What about last, let's say, a year or two ago, when the armory was closed, but the shelters, you know, were running during the summer, let's say the summer of 2014, and the meals were available during that time. People didn't just come from the armory to eat and then leave. They came in for the meals, right, just because the meals were available and they needed something to eat. How did that work, let's say, a couple years ago?
Well,
if you remember.
I remember. That got a little bit rougher, I think. You know, especially when we were feeding a crowd, sometimes of like 200, 250 people out there. If you're going to do that, and there's all kinds of good reasons to do that, you need more security people, okay? But it can be done. It can be done safely. It can be done humanely, you know, and... I don't know, man. You just have to do some basic things for people. And I think we can feed people again there. I think we should.
How long has First Alarm been there since about what time?
Oh, boy. It was after the renovation that First Alarm really started coming on board there. And then...
when was the renovation?
You know, after... Especially, you know, remember that murder down there at Camouflage?
I do. When was the renovation? I think the murder was in 2013, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, that really kind of spawned the First Alarm police thing.
Before that happened, did you feel unsafe there? In other words, before the first alarm security, did you call for security guards yourself? Would you say, oh, we need security guards here to take care of the 200 people who are coming to eat at the meals, who presumably were at that time, right?
Well, no, I didn't think we needed essentially rent-a-cops to do it. I think we could have done with a couple more just staff people, you know, just to monitor people.
What do you feel about the rent-a-cops now? Would you like to see them replaced by staff?
Geez. You know, Robert, I just, if they're going to run this place like a jail, then they're going to need these rent-a-cops around. I don't know. I don't know what they're trying to do. You know, if you're trying to, if you're trying to really kind of help people on a one-on-one kind of humanitarian basis, I don't know about all these rent-a-cops. But I mean, that's not.
I mean, I know what I think
about
the rent-a-cops, but I haven't lived there, and I don't live there, and I'm not likely to live there, so it's easy for me to criticize.
You got to ask yourself, you walk around there, there's an immense amount of money being spent on this and that. I mean, could it be spent better, you know, on other things? You know, like, I read about this episode in the Tenderloin where, you know, they had, of course, they had a crime problem. They come up with an agenda to end the crime problem. One of the things is more police officers, but really, most of it was, you know, better training, vocational stuff, jobs, you know, yada, yada, yada. Well, by the time this thing finally gets a vote, finally gets forward, the only thing people are concentrating on is more police. Okay, all the other liberal social stuff got, you know, neglected and forgotten about. Well, you know, the crime rate didn't go down in the Tenderloin, you know, and the police station they just put down there, you know, later on they made a movie called Apache the Bronx. I think it was after the Tenderloin police station. So, in the same way, are you solving this problem by hiring more rent-a-cops? I don't think so. You know, I think, you know, and boy, here comes the bleeding heart Andy. You know, I think you need to solve these problems by taking these people and giving them a decent place to stay and work and, you know, counseling, food, medical treatment, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, I think when you crunch a bunch of people together like rats, you're going to find they start behaving like trapped animals. And, you know, they'll start doping themselves up. They'll start fighting each other. And so forth. But, you know, what I want to do, since we've been doing at this for about an hour now, and I'm glad that you came on. In fact, what I'd like you to do is consider kind of a weekly report. If you know, we don't have to go on for an hour every week, but if you want to give an update as to stuff you've heard, new thoughts you have on this issue, you know, your observations.
I'd love to. I mean, I'll put my 2 cents first in there. You know, it's like, man, I don't have all the answers to this. I don't have any answers to this, but I'd love to see a group of people get together and start working this problem, you know, because I just feel this, we can solve this. You know, we can solve this. We can come up with a way of really helping people. And that's not what's going on now. Now the homeless shelter is like a giant vacuum to collect society's undesirables and ship them out of the county. You know, and that's how this place is run. It is not run with, let's give this person independence again. Let's give this place dignity again.
So I'm going to leave it there, Andy, and I'm going to again mention that your phone number is 332-2717. Again, if anybody has housing accommodations that Andy is, you're willing to pay for, Andy.
Sure I am. $600 a month. Right,
332-2717, or contact Andy at Andy Carr, Andy like in the automobile car, at sbc.global.net. That's Andy Carr at sbcglobal.net. There's only one dot in there. And I'm going to open the phone lines, Andy, so people can call in. I can't have you on the phone, too, unfortunately, because it's only one line. But this will be available as an archive. at the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom website, which very quickly after the show is over, probably within a couple hours, just go to the Huff website and you can hear more of it if you have access to a computer. And that's true for anybody listening as well as for you, Andy. And I'm hoping we can get some thoughts on what you've said,
yeah,
some reactions. And I'll give you the last word on this.
Well, okay. I'd like for people to call in, whether it's critical of me, whether you want to get angry at me, whatever, or support me or just say hi. But what if I call in, like, next week and I'll answer the criticisms and try to go through the questions?
That sounds great. You can call in on Sunday if you want when we have a longer show. Our Sunday show is 9.
Okay, that'd be cool.
It runs 9:30 to 1 in the afternoon and sometimes longer.
Okay, and then I can answer whatever happens. Yeah.
Sure, contact me after the show. Contact me tomorrow or after the show, and I will pass on to you. Often we don't get any phone calls, so don't get your hopes up.
Okay.
But we might get some people calling in, so...
All right. Hey, Robert, thank you for everything, man.
Well,
okay.
Thank you, man. You know, it is through information and sharing experiences that at least we get a sense of what the hell is going on, at least from the eyes of one person who's been there.
Okay, man. Okay. Hey, everybody, take care. You take care, Robert, and I'll talk to you Sunday.
You too, man. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
And phone lines are open, 427-3772, 427-3772. That was Andy Carcello, who is now at the Association of Faith Communities, and that's a church program that happens for a small number of people every night, and people have to go to different churches every night. He's a survivor of the Paul Lee Loft and the Page Smith Community House. Although, ironically, he wanted to be there longer because he felt that he needed to have some kind of shelter until he was able to work out the financial problems he had. And he had his numerous, I think, very telling criticisms, if they're accurate, of the programs there. So if you want to call in and talk about any of this, your own experiences, your sense of what you heard, any alternate information you may have, 427-3772 is the number to call. And while I'm waiting for that flood of calls, here's Talking Dust Bowl Blues.
Back in 1927, I had a little farm and I called it heaven. Prices up and rain come down and I hauled my crops all into town. I got the money. Bought clothes and groceries. Fed the kids. Took it easy. Rain it quit and the wind got high and the black old dust storms filled the sky and I swapped my farm for a Ford machine and I filled it full of this gas Eileen and started rolling and drifting to California. Way up yonder on a mountain road I had a hot motor and a heavy load. I was going pretty fast, I wasn't even stopping. I was bouncing up and down like popcorn and popping. Had a breakdown, sort of a nervous bust down of the mechanism there, some kind of engine trouble. Here's away up yonder on the mountain road, I wasn't feeling so very good, and I give this rolling Ford a shove, and I was going to coast as far as I could. Commenced rolling, picking up speed, and there was a hairpin turn, and I couldn't make it. Man alive, I'm telling you, the fiddles and the guitars really flew. That Ford took off like a flying squirrel, and it flew halfway around the world. Scattered wives and children all over the side of that mountain. Got the old Los Angeles broke, so that gum hungry we thought we'd choke. And I bummed up a spud or two, and my wife cooked up a tater stew. Fed the kids a big bait of it, but that was mighty thin stew. So that gum thin, you could pretty near read a magazine through it. If it had been just a little bit thinner, I've always believed that stew had been just a little bit thinner, some of our senators could have seen through it.
And that was Talkin' Dust Bowl Blues, Woody Guthrie. My apologies, the phone lines are now open. They weren't a moment ago, but they are now, 427-3772. If you've got anything you want to say, and now your passions have died, I hope you can still resurrect them, bring them back up. I apologize for not having the phone lines open. 427-3772. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris, and this is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. And I'd have some reports on the art censorship trial of Joff and Alex. That's Joff Jones, also known as Jonathan Jones, and Alex Skelton, who are the two artists who have been arrested five times and hauled away by police for displaying their art on Pacific Avenue outside the sacred blue boxes or disced areas on Pacific Avenue that you're supposed to be inside if you want to exercise your First Amendment right to display your artwork or play your music. And these two artists have felt this is... that the First Amendment is their permit. They don't need to be inside these constricted boxes that only allow access to a fraction of the sidewalk if you have anything like a table or any kind of device that your paintings are hanging from. Or even if you're sitting there with a cap showing a painting in your lap, because the cap is considered a so-called display device, and you're only allowed inside these areas. It's obviously an attempt to constrict, restrict, and essentially minimize activity on Pacific Avenue. Some would say, of course, civilize it, but that kind of civilization isn't really the civilization I had in mind when I, when I came to town, when I came through town, when I've lived in town, and... I hope it's not your idea either. Let's go to some interviews. All I can tell you about that trial is that it was in the basement of Department 10. Alex and Joff were keeping a very kind of a tight, well, they're not saying much about, they didn't publicize the trial. I had to go to the courts to find out it was happening, because they apparently feel that if they can work out a deal with the... then the judges and the commissioners, they will be best advised. They'll get some. I think they're going to get justice in these courts, which I think is unlikely. But I hope they do. And from what I saw in the court of Kim Baskett, and I sat through an hour and a half of this on Tuesday, Kim Baskett did give them some leeway in presenting their defense. They had brought along a very thick docket of documents, 30 different exhibits and more in terms of argument, which you have to present your exhibits and all the evidence you're presenting both to the judge and to the prosecutor, which means you have to make copies. And they hadn't done this. They had a copy for the judge, but they didn't have a copy for the city attorney, who showed up with three cops, which kind of indicates how seriously the city is taking this essentially civil resistance to the law. Actually, I guess I might call it civil disobedience rather than civil resistance. The difference being, if you're civilly disobedient, it means you are challenging the law in order to overturn it, claiming that it's unconstitutional. If you're civilly resistant, you're saying it violates human rights. You don't care what kind of legal excuses they're using. It's wrong, and you're going to fight it nonviolently, perhaps, or by other means. But in any case, that's civil resistance, which can lead to civil uprisings, insurrections, war, or massive boycotts. There are all kinds of methods of civil resistance, many of which would be a hell of a better idea than going along passively with the kind of situation we have now in Santa Cruz and in other towns, in my belief. But in any case, they were into a very prepared and studied defense Alex and Joff were, and their documents were in order, and they were prepared to commit their defense. But the judge said, look, you've got to give these copies to the prosecution, so we'll postpone this. And then she worked out a way of having them get the copies copied at the district, at the city attorney's office. It wasn't a district attorney matter. City attorney is the city attorney hired by the city of Santa Cruz. District attorney is a county official who deals with more serious crimes or with state infractions when those happen. Happened without happening much at all. So the trial will happen again. I didn't stay for the end of this since it seemed to be going on and going nowhere, but I will be checking next week to see what the status of this is, and maybe I'll have more information on Sunday. Also have more information on Sunday, I'm hoping, about the upcoming shitty council meeting, which is every other Tuesday, second and fourth Tuesday, actually, of every month. And so there should be one coming up at the end of the month. Actually, at the beginning of the month, I should say. Let's see. It'll be a week from Tuesday, because the first Tuesday is not when it happens, and the first Tuesday will be next Tuesday. So it's going to be Tuesday after next. So unless they have some special meeting, which we'll see if they do, in which case I'll try to pass on that information to all you folks out there. There was an interesting city council endorsement meeting and forum on Monday night, which they had 10 of the 11 candidates there, and there were several of the local political groups that held their sort of caucuses to see who they would endorse for the Santa Cruz City Council races. Four that were endorsed by the Bend Over for Bernie group, as I call them, which is to say those who are big fans of Bernie as a Democratic candidate, Bernie Sanders, now have to, I don't know if they're going to be voting for Hillary Clinton or not, but it's been my concern and my observation that Bernie was simply a shill for the Democratic Party, although, you know, he may have had certainly has some sincere ideas about what he'd like to see, but his main primary loyalty is to a Democratic Party. Business as usual politics, if necessary, to keep the committee chairs that he holds, and of course to avoid the menace of Trump, which is always, of course, what the Democrats pull when it comes to an election. Anyway, so this group, the Bernie group, which actually has I didn't look at it very closely, but their platform in the Santa Cruz level, they were requesting that candidates consider supporting a number of things, and they had five different potential candidates who were running to support different aspects of their platform, which I think I'll try to bring on Sunday. I don't think I have a copy of it here, and I'll try to be better prepared and bring it on Sunday if I can, or if anybody wants to call in and talk about what that platform is. There was a vote after the election forum, which was had, as I said, 10 of the 11 candidates. Only five of these candidates were being considered by the Bernie supporters, and I think another progressive group in Santa Cruz. And these were Sandy Brown, Steve Plaich, Steve Schnarr, Chris Crone, and Drew Glover. And four of these were selected, and it was everybody but Plaich, who got a surprisingly low number of votes. I've always been ragging on poor Steve Plaich's case, and will continue to, no doubt, and as long as he holds positions where he claims he's engaged in homeless support, where he is engaged in homeless support in different ways, for sure, but where I feel that is either misrepresented or inadequately presented, or he has a lot more power than he's using, I will bring it up. It's been the case with the ACLU and a couple of other organizations, too, MHCAN and so forth. But generally, Steve Plaich has been accessible and active in trying to resolve issues. And maybe I'm saying this because I'm a friend of his, and I kind of feel a little depressed that, although I think, I got to tell you, that these city council elections are the wrong thing to put your energy into generally. And I've talked about this to people. I talked about this at the meeting. I was doing a little bit of razzing from the back, not much. It would have been better if I were doing more, I think. But I did a little bit. When Cynthia Matthews went on to talk about avoiding, you know, not giving a straight answer to the issue of the right to sleep in Santa Cruz, or giving a nasty answer. I think it was, I guess it was an honest answer in a way. She doesn't think homeless people have the right to sleep. You know, she was blathering on about affordable housing that isn't there. She's our mayor, and she's also running for re-election. And we get nonsense. I shouted out shame from the back, and the chair turned around and growled at me that I should be quiet, and I said no. I mean, I didn't keep going because I wanted the forum to continue, but it's really important in these cases, even if you're Rochelle Narayan shouting at the Coastal Commission, to be able to speak your piece to these bureaucratic bodies, even when the body is a bunch of citizens who aren't government people, but who have nonetheless set up a kind of a structure where they feel where they're going to shut any questions down and any comments down that don't fit into their format. And that is, you know, I have to admit to that, doing that myself at the meetings I'm at a certain point. But I try not to do it without at least allowing a little discussion. It depends, I suppose. Any case, we have a situation where the problem with putting attention into the city council races is that you are really voting for people who are not going to make changes even if they want to, and who are also not going to get elected, no matter how much energy they put into considering the amount of money and power that's against them. But even if they got elected, what they have facing them is an entrenched and well-paid staff. The city attorney, the police chief, the city manager, the head of parks and rec, who run the city, who create essentially the ordinances, who get the ordinances passed by the city council with very rare exceptions, and who proceed as they want. And for any council to change that is highly unlikely. What might change that is masses of people, you know, acting in a direct action way and demanding changes, whether peacefully or not so peacefully, but demanding those changes. And when the power of the people is seen, then eventually, as Chris Krohn likes to intone, although he never actually acts on these issues, although he uses a lot of rhetoric, he's running for city council, he's a former council member and a former mayor, when the people lead, the leaders will follow. And that's very nice. But if you're a leader, if you claim to be a leader at city council, yeah, to me, your responsibility is to speak up on issues, even if it's unpopular, even if you don't have bunches of people. That's something Michael Posner, for instance, had a lot of trouble doing, I believe, although he did so occasionally. And he did so with a few negative votes to the right-wing juggernaut, the right-wing riptide, as I call it, that's passing through city council. So I'll be talking more about that on Sunday, the city council races and the city council. But really, I'm kind of contradicting myself. What people need to be doing is focusing on other things, like the struggle for real issues, rent control, fighting police abuse, dealing with racial and class discrimination in Santa Cruz, real estate speculation. I mean, stuff that could be dealt with, you know, through creative direct action. And I would say even action that tries to make real reforms or protect services that are being threatened by right-wing vigilantism, such as MH Can. And let's hear a little bit now from some folks out there for the last few minutes here, and then we will say goodbye and let Uncle Dennis come into the studio with his music and Earth First updates, or environmental updates. I'm not sure if they're still Earth First updates. They probably are, at 8 o'clock. So there.
So it's the only a 50 or 60 person strong red church. Line has just started, and I'm checking to see if anybody has any street reports.
Every day, it never stops.
And we're talking to...
I don't want to say my name.
No problem. And anything specific in the struggle today you've noticed?
Could you repeat that question?
In other words, anything happened today or the last few days that you want people to know about?
No, everything is the same every day. Nothing changes. Nothing changes. The poor will always be poor. I was surprised when I see white people homeless. Yeah, I was shocked.
It happens.
Yeah. So... anybody think it's butter and bread? It's not. The struggle goes on every day, and it's not getting better. It's getting worse.
Any particular activity with police you've noticed?
Harassing poor people.
Anything specific you've seen?
Not really. They do the same thing over and over every day.
It's boring to watch.
Yeah, it is.
And we've been talking to a man who would prefer to say who he is, but thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
All right. Any reports from the street? Any reports for your many fans out there?
My many fans. Actually, I have some reports.
Right.
Santa Cruz Full-Timers has some reports that there was a sheriff visit a few weeks back out as far as Scott Creek, giving a heads up to RV campers out there that things might be changing soon. And then I've also been told that there is some kind of sheriff possibly...
anything for the worse?
As far as no more camping. And then also, for RVs anyway, and then also...
you mean parking in your vehicle by the side of the road.
That's correct. And they're also shining lights in vehicles, and if the law enforcement can see the individuals in the cars, then they told them to move along, but they did not tell the RVs to move along on Highway 1 recently. And there's some new signage on the first turnout on Highway 1 when you're heading out of town, some parking restrictions. I haven't had a chance to see the signage.
Let me ask you about this really a little more closely.
And before we hear my fine questions, just kind of a clarification, and this is something that was confused by activists who are big fans of banning RVs in Santa Cruz, but were at least temporarily held at bay by the Coastal Commission and the city. In the county, however, as I've mentioned in other shows, the county has passed a law banning RVs in an even broader area and a longer period of time, completely overnight, parked anywhere in the county. And that law, I've requested the Coastal Commission staff to examine. I haven't heard anything back from them yet, so I'm going to have to press them on that issue, and I hope I do. I seem to be distracted in a number of ways, and I hope somebody else presses them if I don't. If you want to be able to park your RV or your friends to be able to park the RV, even if you're not sleeping in it, which isn't camping, parking your RV is not camping unless you are, in fact, engaging in living in it and sleeping in it inside and at night. And you can do it during the day. It's legal. Although, there are questions about living in it in the county. They've got some strange rules, which I'm going to have to look very closely at the wording again. It's been a while since I spent much time looking at that. But there is a difference between the one of the reasons that the Coastal Commission voted to hold up on supporting this city law banning RVs is that it bans the parking of RVs during the late hours of the night, even if there's nobody in them. And that is more severe than banning people from camping. Because people are already banned from camping throughout the city, even though there's no place to go except some so-called programs to housing, which you heard Andy Carcello talk about rather dramatically in terms of how inadequate they are or how wretched they are. And so there's a difference between camping and parking an RV. In the coastal areas on the north, and north of the city and along Davenport and Scott's Creek, Julie Shule of the Santa Cruz Full-Timers does keep an eye on this stuff, and I'm glad she does. You can find her Facebook page, has a lot of information there, and links with the sheriff's page so you can see what the sheriff is telling folks. I tried to see if there was anything new, if there were any actual citations being given out by the sheriff's department, and I haven't been able to find anything. I'm not really looking at the if there is a record of sheriff's infractions. I haven't yet located it, but I haven't heard of any incidents verbally, either from Julie or anyone else, the tickets have been given. So it could be that the Sheriff's Department is, in spite of its claim that it's enforcing and its move-along demands for RVs, that this is more of a bluff and a threat. It could be that it's not as well. So, for instance, I noted that downtown there was a lot of threats to enforce the commercial vending law, and there didn't seem to be much actual action, but that's changed in the last several weeks. James the Jeweler has gotten two vending tickets and several tickets for not moving along, and I think that may have forced him to pull in his... to vacate the avenue for a while. At least I haven't seen him there. Similarly, the much more extensive jeweler who has been setting up tables on Pacific Avenue, sometimes under religious auspices, has moved to Front Street or Cedar Street. It sounds like we have a caller. Yo, caller, you're on free radio.
Hey, Robert, how's it going?
Well, it's going. We got about 5 minutes left in the show. It sounds like, is this that former jailbird, Andrea?
You got that right.
So you were jailed for being on the median again, flying a sign, of asking for assistance?
Wasn't even flying a sign. A lot of times I don't even fly a sign. I just sit there. Sometimes I put my handicap placard out hanging off my walker, but I really haven't much use to sign. I haven't had to. You know, people know what's up, and, you know, pretty cool about it for the most part.
And were you there today?
No. I got out this morning, but I came home. I wasn't there today, though.
So you were jailed, and did you get a court date? Did they just drop?
Yep. And yeah, so, I got a court date September 27th at 8:30.
And what are you charged
Department
with?
Department 1.
Wow.
Well, I found out that it had something to do with the little incident that happened on May 14th with Officer Sloppy Hoppy. He lied and said that that I resisted arrest, and this public defender came over. And, well, she's getting reassigned, so I'll have to talk to this other public defender. But I told her, I said, that's not what happened at all. There was no resisting arrest whatsoever, so I'm going to be contesting that. Because she told me this morning, too, she goes, well, you can plead guilty, and then, like, you know, basically get out today or plead not guilty, and you might have to stay in. And I was like, well, I have to get out today because I have to get my butt home and I got to pay rent. You know, I just can't, and plus I just can't stay in here. So, but I was able to plead not guilty and I got out today. So thank God for that. But Hoppy's a liar. He lies.
Who was the judge?
Good time.
Who was the judge, Andrea, who let you out?
His name starts with an M. Dark haired guy.
Maraganda?
Yeah, Maraganda.
Oh, that's good. So Maraganda gave you a no-bail release, huh?
I guess.
He released you on your own recognizance. So.
Yeah. Thank God.
So the public defender misadvised you that you had to plead guilty in order to get out of jail, correct?
Yeah, at first.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then, but I told her, I said, look, I have to get out today, but I told her that, you know, Officer Hoppy lied. That is not what happened at all. And she told that to the judge, and it was kind of funny. He made the comment of like something like, yeah, I believe it is true. Like, he believes that I'm telling the truth, you know, which is kind of cool. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens on September 27th.
What's the name of your public defender, Andrea?
I don't know. Because she's got reassigned it, I have to call this other guy. She gave me a card, and his name's Chris something. She said if you went, you know, for her assistance, you know, this guy might be calling me, actually, because I gave her the number here at the motel and everything and the room number.
Well, what? Let me ask you this, Andrea. What was her name? Do you know?
I can't remember. I really can't remember because she didn't really... I don't know if she stated her name or not. She probably did, but I can't remember. She came up and she came over and said, "Hi, I'm so and so, and I'll be taking your case."
Yeah, I gotcha. So first she told you that you had to plead guilty, but then she told the. Did you have to say in court that you wanted to plead not guilty, or did she say that for you?
She kind of said it for me that I was pleading
That's
not
good.
Guilty, but he OR'd me anyway. You know.
So I thought you told her that you wanted to get out, so you said that you would plead guilty if you needed to in order to get out, right?
No, she said, I'll see what I can do to get you out today without you having to. I can't remember it all, Robert. Oh, I don't know. It just happened so fast. The main thing is I was able to plead not guilty, and he gave me a court date. That's all I can
say. September 21st in Department 1?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, September 27th at 8:30 in Department 1.
27th. And what? At 8:30, okay.
Yeah, at 8:30.
And that's a pretrial or that's a trial, do you know?
I think it's a pretrial. I think he said pretrial. I don't know what the difference is, but
okay, well,
I'm
pretty sure
he said pretrial.
Keep us posted on this, Andrea. I got to run on you, but anything else you want to report quickly before I cut you off?
No, I just wanted to let you know that I was out and kind of what the update was, because I had to ask the public defender, because I didn't know. I said, you know, I'm not really sure what the judge is talking about. I don't know which date he's actually referring to, because I've gotten so many tickets from so many officers, and there's been so much happening that is. And I asked her, I said, is he referring to the incident that happened on May 14th with Officer Hoppy? And she says, yeah. I said, oh, okay, that's what I thought. And he's full of shit. I'm going to nail him to the cross when I get in there on the 27th. I'm telling you what.
Now, do you intend to go back and continue hanging out on the median in order to demonstrate that you're looking for something, you know?
I don't know. See, one of the conditions that I had to agree to today was that, you know, he's going to OR me, whatever, blah, 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 and yet I have to agree to stay off that median, you know? And I was, like, looking at the public defender and saying, well, how am I going to survive? That's the only real way I can survive. She goes, I don't know. She's like, well, what about food stamps? You get food stamps? I said, no, I can't get food stamps. She's like, I don't know. You know, borrow from your friends or whatever. It's like, you know, she, I mean, she, you know, it's not her fault, though. She didn't really know what to say.